Welcome back to part two of Next on the Tee. We're not done yet. Coming up, more stories, more insight, and more reasons to love this game. Let's dive right back in. Part two starts now, right here on Next on the Tee, where golf legends live and your game gets better.
Hey, Next on the Tee Nation, thank you so much for coming back and pressing play on part two of this episode featuring my conversation with the great David Moore. David is the curator of collections at Oakmont Country Club, plus he does some work for some of the other historical courses in and around the Western Pennsylvania area. Allegheny Country Club alongside Montclair Golf Club, Youngstown Country Club, and Westmoreland Country Club as well. So a lot of work being done by David, and he does such outstanding work. This time around, David is back to update us on the wonderful work that he has done on a book that he has co-authored, Battling the Church Pews, The History of Golf's Premier Events in Western Pennsylvania. A second edition of the book has been released, so you get five new chapters. David's written three of them, so you'll hear all about that. Plus, David and I will look back to this year's U.S. Open that was played there at Oakmont. Tough conditions, fantastic golf tournament, so you'll hear his insights and stories from that. Plus, we also get into a lot of other things around that golf course. We'll talk about how Henry Fones wanted that golf course to play. He wanted it tough, and if it wasn't playing tough and he was out there witnessing it, a bad shot wasn't penalized. He made sure that anyone that hit from that area again next time, it sure was going to get penalized the next time that he saw it. So you'll hear about that. David also talks about Mr. Palmer's home course up in Latrobe and what it was like when he did some work there and having the king down at Oakmont. We also get into a lot of other fantastic things like Ben Hogan's 1953 season, the slam that could have been if the Open Championship and the PGA Championship weren't being held at the same time. Ben Hogan might have won the modern-day Grand Slam, so we'll talk a little bit about that as well. We can't talk about Oakmont and the U.S. Open without looking back to the incident with Wyndham Clark damaging two of the lockers, and they're historic lockers, as a matter of fact. So I wanted to get David's opinion on that, and you'll hear it. So, folks, David's fantastic, as I say. A lot of great information, a lot of great things for us to get into. You're really going to enjoy his insights and his historical views and the things that he is going to share. So sit back, relax, let us take your mind off everything else going on in your life for the next half hour or so. Okay, but before we get into all of those great stories and insights, I want to remind you about our friends over at 2Under. 2Under men's performance briefs are the unofficial underwear of the PGA, Ryder Cup, and President's Cup teams, and are sold in over 3,000 golf pro shops and golf specialty retailers nationwide. Ricky Fowler is their global ambassador, and over 50 other PGA, Korn Ferry, and Champions Tour players wear them. Just to mention a few, they are David Toms, Jerry Kelly, Justin Thomas, William McGirt, Scott McCarron, and Chris DeMarco. The Joey Pouch technology provides the ultimate male asset management, delivering maximum comfort from the tee box to the boardroom to the bedroom. Go to 2under.com to check out the bundle specials that offer substantial discounts for being a Next on the Tee listener. That's the number 2UNDR.com. 2Under, performance in your pants.
Sure, this is golf, but so is this. And this. And this is definitely golf. And so is this. Hey, that's not golf. Oh, wait, yeah, it is. And no matter what your golf is, you're gonna need a store. No, a superstore. A place to get fit for a new club and walk out with it the same day. A place to find the perfect fit. A place to do whatever this is. Because this is golf. And this is golf's superstore.
Okay, now back in Next on the Tee with me is David Moore. David is the curator of collections out at Oakmont Country Club and a part-time curator of history at Allegheny Country Club. Plus, he also consults with our friends over at the Pittsburgh Field Club, as well as Montclair Golf Club, Youngstown Country Club, and Westmoreland Country Club. He earned his Bachelor of Arts degree in American History at Pitt, then his Master of Arts in Applied History at the University of Massachusetts. He's co-authored a wonderful book titled Battling the Church Pews, The History of Golf's Premier Events in Western Pennsylvania. The second edition of that book is now available out on Amazon. I was lucky enough to get to spend a few minutes with him at Oakmont during the U.S. Open, and I couldn't be more excited to get to spend more time with him this week here on Next on the Tee. Hey, David, thanks for coming back on the show.
Of course, Chris. Thanks for having me. It's great to be back.
David, I want to start out by going back to U.S. Open week. We got a lot of rain, which was unfortunate, but how'd you feel about how the course held up and it played?
I think everybody really would have preferred a drier spring. Just overall, there was about 15 inches of rain starting, I think, April 1st and through the championship week. All of us really felt hard for Mike and his staff that put so much time and effort into making that golf course, such a tough test for a national championship. And, you know, they had to deal with the rain all spring and then the week of, you know, too, a little bit. But, overall, I thought Oakmont, showed its colors, its true colors. It played really difficult, which is exactly what the USGA and, you know, the club was hoping for. And, when all was said and done, I remember sitting at media day and our club president said, we'd love to have another over par winner. And, we got pretty close. There was only one guy to break par. So that was right up our alley. So we were certainly happy about that.
And David, several of the players seemed frustrated with how difficult the course did play. But to me, that's Oakmont. Regardless of the rain, it tests every aspect of your game, including your mental toughness, how well you're able to deal with adversity, particularly when your ball found itself into that thick, thick rough. Shouldn't the players just expect that that's what you're going to get when you play at Oakmont?
I would certainly think so. Oakmont seems to be one of those places that guys kind of, psych themselves out before they even tee it up on Thursday afternoon. I go back to, I think it was 2016, that Open. I remember watching Bubba Watson's press conference, right, Tuesday or Wednesday that week, and he flat out said, he's like, I don't have a snowball's chance in hell of winning here. And I thought, you finished tied for fifth 8 years ago. Like, how could you possibly feel that way? And, I think it's definitely one of those courses that, you walk in and I thought John Rahm said it perfectly in his pre-tournament press conference. He's like, this is a place where there's an aura about it. You walk in and you know where you are. You know how difficult this golf course is, how special this golf course is. And, I think the guys that get that ultimately are the guys that ended up playing well. You saw Rahm finish, I think he finished T7 or somewhere right around there. I think the guys that buy into it's going to be difficult. It's Oakmont. We know it's going to be every bit of a brute of a beast that it can be. And if you embrace that challenge and do everything you can to, make sure you minimize your mistakes, then you should do fine. And I think the guys that ultimately find themselves at the top of the leaderboard come Sunday night are the guys that buy into that.
David, so many of the players have told me that Oakmont is the most difficult course they've ever played. And isn't that exactly how the membership and how Henry Fones, the original owner and course designer, isn't that exactly what they were going for?
Yeah, that's exactly what Henry wanted. Henry wanted the golf course to be a true Darwinian test. He felt that if you didn't hit the perfect shot every shot, you should be punished for it. And, the longstanding quote from the club is, a shot misplayed is a shot irrevocably lost. And, that's held true since the era of the Fones is up to the modern day with the best players in the world playing. Hit the perfect shot or, unfortunately be punished for it. And, when it comes to a U.S. Open, the guys that tend to win are the guys that minimize their mistakes. And if they do make a mistake, they don't try to pull the hero shot. They take their medicine and they try to their best to save par, at the very least save bogey and move on to the next hole. And we tend to see that happen at Oakmont better than anywhere else.
You mentioned the word aura a moment ago, and David, Oakmont wasn't Mr. Palmer's home course. That was obviously up in Latrobe, but it feels like Mr. Palmer is always a part of Oakmont. Talk about the spirit and the aura of the king that is over Oakmont Country Club.
There's just something to Mr. Palmer. I always tell people, if you ever get the chance to go to Latrobe or you get the chance to play at Laurel Valley or just be at Laurel Valley, there's something about those two places where you feel his eyes and his presence there, whether you're in the bar or in the locker room or on one of the tee boxes. You know, Oakmont's one of those places too. And, you know, unfortunately, he never won, you know, a national or major championship there. He won a West Penn Junior, I believe, or West Penn Amateur there at one point in his career. But it's certainly a place that, you know, Mr. Palmer had a huge affinity for. And, you know, it's with him being so interwoven with the fabric of Western Pennsylvania, you know, he feels like somebody that's always there, even though he's been gone now for, geez, what is it, 9 years now. Yeah, it's amazing how you go to these places and you feel him there with you. And, you know, I would say probably Latrobe and Laurel Valley more so, but there is certainly something to feeling, you know, Mr. Palmer and Oakmont, and even, you know, not even just him, you know, the other great ghosts of the past, you know, Ben Hogan and Bobby Jones and, you know, names like that. You know, you can kind of feel the presence of these great men, these great champions, you know, especially during a championship week. It really is something special.
David, volume 2 of Battling the Church Pews is now available. You've updated it with some stories from this year's U.S. Open, plus some of the non-majors that have been played in and around Western Pennsylvania. What can everybody look forward to when they go out and pick up volume 2?
Well, the biggest addition is the 2025 chapter. I was lucky enough that I got to pen that one. It probably is the longest chapter in the book. As I said to my co-authors when I submitted it, I said, I went over our word limit by quite a bit. And they said, well, we're already at almost 500 pages. What's a couple extra? And I said, all right, well, that's good. So the 2025 chapter for sure is, I think one of my favorite chapters I got to write in the book, and definitely one of the big parts of the second edition. The other big chapters that we included, we did a chapter on the Sonny Hanna Amateur, which, you know, I think was probably a big omission from the first one. It's probably, you know, it's one of the biggest national amateur championships in the country. And, you know, we didn't necessarily intend to leave it out, but we wanted to focus on, you know, these other, you know, national championships like the USGA championships and PGA of America championships. And, you know, when we were doing the second edition, we felt that, you know, this was an opportunity to go back and look at it. And the same thing with the National Public Links Amateur Championship. You know, it's now defunct, but, you know, we've hosted, I believe there was 3 in Western Pennsylvania, 1 in Erie and 2 here in Pittsburgh. And, you know, we had a couple U.S. Public Links champions coming out of Pittsburgh, Carl Kaufman and Andy Swedko. So it seemed like the perfect opportunity to update on a couple things that, you know, we left out of the first edition. We were able to go back in and dedicate a chapter, 2 short chapters to the Western Pennsylvania Golf Association and their 2 biggest championships, their Open and their Amateur, and the history and the legacy behind those titles and those championships. And, you know, one of the other fun things that we did, we went in and made corrections of new stuff that we've learned and things like that. And then we took a different look at the golf course chapter for Oakmont. You know, when we wrote it for the first edition, it was really meant to kind of be like a yardage guide for the guests, you know, somebody that might be attending the Open, and how the hole should play and things like that. And, you know, an aspect of that is still in this edition, but, you know, we kind of shift gears and looked at, you know, the history of each hole and some of those stories that, you know, we found or that we left out the first go around to kind of give you more of a description of what the hole is as opposed to the history of it. But, so I think overall there's 5 new chapters in total in the second edition, and then a couple chapters got some pretty serious revisions. So I think it's a great second edition. We're really excited for it. Just came out last week on Amazon, and we're hoping that if you didn't grab a first edition copy, you'll grab a second edition, and we hope that if you did grab a first edition, you'll still grab a second edition.
Let's take all that a step further, David. There are some stories that when I was going through the first edition of the book, let mm-hmm. alone the second, that a lot of people I don't think know about. Mm-hmm. You have a favorite story that probably most people don't know about when they read the book?
You know, the Churchill Valley chapter was a lot of fun.
Yes, I was hoping you were going there.
You know, I never had the opportunity to play it, and it's been gone now for about 12 years. And that was a lot of fun to write because I really had to dig. You know, the internet offered very few storylines, really, to the history of the club. So, you know, I was able to kind of go back and track, you know, some of the championships, like obviously the women's majors and West Penn and PA events. And then from there, it was getting in touch with some of the past members. You know, I'm fortunate enough that I'm connected with a few of them that are, you know, that were there that are at Oakmont and other, a couple of the other clubs that I work with. And, you know, digging up some of these stories, you know, every one of them, every one of those past members that I talked to, you know, they all kind of said the same thing in one phrasing or another. And they basically said it was the most fun I ever had at a club and there'll never be another place like it. And I kind of thought that was really interesting that everybody had that affinity for it. And, you know, unfortunately, it's been lost to time. The clubhouse is gone. The golf course is overgrown. It's now a public green space. But you know, the bones of it are all still there. The walking paths or the cart paths and things like that. So I would say the Churchill Valley history, the club history chapter was probably my favorite to dig into and write. Cause I really had to dig and I really had to try to piece that story together and find these people and these events and try to bring it back to life. And I really had a lot of fun with that one.
David, you mentioned Ben Hogan a little bit ago, and you've also written several wonderful articles for just about every golf publication out there. A few months ago, you wrote a piece for the USGA about Mr. Hogan's 1953 season. Mm-hmm. People talk about the Tiger Slam back in 2000 and 2001, and that was obviously an amazing feat, historic, and all of that, but not enough people know about what Mr. Hogan accomplished in 1953. And heck, he might have won the Grand Slam that year if it hadn't been for the fact that the PGA Championship overlapped the Open. The U.S. Open was held back there at Oakmont again back in 53. Talk about everything that went into it, because you just didn't get into tournaments back then, especially the U.S. Open. You had to qualify unless you were the defending champion. Everybody else had to qualify. Talk about what Mr. Hogan went through playing in Pittsburgh, playing at Oakmont, playing at the Field Club, just to get into the field, and then the Triple Crown season that he had.
Yeah, so Ben Hogan is one of my favorite, like, most fascinating characters in golf history. I cannot find a book about him that I have not devoured and adored. When it comes to 1953, I think it's one of the greatest seasons of all time. You know, Tiger's 2000 is definitely up there. You know, Bobby Jones's Grand Slam in 1930s there. But, you know, Hogan's 53 is so special, especially considering, you know, he's just a couple years removed from the accident and he's playing such a limited schedule. So he only played six events in 1953 and he won five of them. Three of them were major championships. And the only one he lost, I think he finished in a tie for fifth. And, you know, he had won the Masters in April. And, you know, in today's day and age, it's unfathomable that he would have had to go and qualify for the Open, but that was the case, even as the reigning Masters champion and a three-time U.S. Open champion. In fact, he'd won, he'd won 50, 51, finished, I think, runner-up in 52, and then, you know, going into 53, but he still had to go and qualify. He qualified, all the players had to, except for the defending champion, Julius Burroughs, and you played 18 at Oakmont, you played 18 at the Field Club. The Field Club was very well regarded by the players. In fact, Sam Snead, I think, said, "Why aren't we playing the tournament here?" And, you know, Hogan had to make a tricky putt there to make sure he made it into the final field. And then once he was in the field, you know, he kind of set out to figure out how to conquer the beast, so to speak. And James Dodson's book on Hogan, Ben Hogan in American Life, does such a great job of really kind of laying out the 1953 season. And one of the most fascinating parts of that was, you know, he had walked one of the practice rounds with Arthur Daly, who was a big columnist for the New York Times at that point. And, you know, Hogan was very open with him, which was very, very unusual. And, you know, he basically kind of walked Daly through his strategy hole to hole. And they got to number 17, and he turned to Daly and said, "This is the hole that will make or break the champion." And, you know, Hogan's out there trying to figure out how he's going to conquer this beast of a golf course. And a lot of the players were kind of rebelling against the USGA at that point. At that time, Oakmont was known for their treacherous furrowed bunkers, which, you know, the bunkers at that point were not, you know, your typical, you know, bunker sand that we're all used to today. It was river sand dredge from the Allegheny River right down over the hill from the club. And, you know, it was coarse, it was dense, it was pebble laden. And then the club would rake the bunker perpendicular to the hole with a rake with 4-inch long steel tines that was often referred to as the devil's back scratcher. And it would create these incredibly deep furrows. The golf ball would sit down in between. And it was, you know, damn near impossible to advance the ball forward. If you were going to get it out, you almost always had to pitch out sideways. And, you know, the players had complained in 35, the amateur players complained in 38. And, you know, WC Phones was still alive and the president of the club at that time and basically said, you know, the members play this every day this way. If you can't play it for 7 days, you don't deserve to be the national champion. And, you know, that kind of put the, you know, a rest to it. But by 53, you know, the Phones era was over. WC had passed away 3 years earlier. And, you know, the players revolted. And, you know, they came to an agreement between the USGA, the club, and the players to have the furrows around the greenside bunkers, but they would be taken out of the fairway bunkers. And, you know, Hogan's just worried about how he's going to beat the golf course. He's not worried about, you know, what's out there. And, you know, he steps up on the first tee Thursday morning and ends up shooting the course record, shoots 5 under 67, hits all 14 fairways. I think he hits 16 or 17 of greens in regulation. And, you know, he shoots this magical round and ends up being the first of only 28 players in history to break par in a U.S. Open at Oakmont, which I think is pretty amazing. And then decided to go play in the Open Championship at Carnoustie afterwards. The first and only time he would play in the Open Championship. Ended up qualifying, kind of had a rough first two rounds, and then shot 5 under over the last 36 holes to win the Claret Jug. And, you know, he got the first three legs of the Grand Slam or modern Grand Slam. And unfortunately couldn't play in the PGA Championship because of the scheduling conflict. And, you know, and I often question whether he would have anyway, simply because the PGA at that point was still a match play tournament. It was 7 days of the first day was 36 hole stroke play qualifier and then 6 days of matches. I think the first three rounds were 18 hole matches. And then the last three rounds were 36 hole matches. So, you know, he would have been playing well over 200 holes most likely, which, you know, with his legs and the injuries sustained during the accident, probably would have been a little too much for him physically to handle. He really struggled doing, 72 holes over 3 days during the U.S. Open. So I don't personally believe Hogan would have even tried to play, even if he could have. But, you know, if he had the chance to win all four, he may have at least tried. So only, you know, it's one of the big what ifs. What if the PGA and the Open Championship weren't the same week? Could Hogan have done it?
Right. You did a wonderful feature for Golf Magazine about the clubhouse there at Oakmont. Mm-hmm. Talk about the locker room, the booze locker within the lockers, and the metal spike marks on the benches in the locker room put there by the greatest players of all time, because the original benches are still there.
Yeah, Oakmont's locker room is truly one of those hallowed grounds in golf. You know, it dates back to the creation of the clubhouse in 1904. And, you know, all these pine lockers with metal lattice, you know, fronts, they're simple, but they're beautiful. They're elegant. And then inside, a lot of the I do have to amend my statement in some of those videos with Golf Magazine and Sports Illustrated. I said every locker has it. And I later found out that the new lockers built within the last 20 years do not. But all the original lockers do have this little booze locker included for that were installed during Prohibition. So all the players could keep their whiskey and their gin in their locker after a round. But I think by far the coolest thing are the benches. You know, they're the old, these old wooden benches that are just full of little black pock marks. And it's literally 120 years of metal spikes of the best players in the world leaving their footprints in the wood in these benches. So, you know, you sit down to change your shoes or you know, change your outfit after or before a round, and, you know, you're literally sitting on a bench that Ben Hogan tied his shoes on, or Bobby Jones or Jack Nicklaus or Arnold Palmer. You know, we talked earlier about, you know, the aura of Oakmont. I think that locker room is a big part of that. You know, it's such a throwback to the original days. There's no air conditioning, and you have these original benches and these original lockers, you know, an ode to Prohibition with the booze lockers inside. And, you know, it's one of those places where you can truly feel the ghost of the past.
David, we're on the heels of the Ryder Cup. Many people probably don't remember that it was played, and you mentioned Laurel Valley earlier. It was played at Laurel Valley Golf Club back in 1975. Laurel Valley is another historic course and a favorite of Mr. Palmer's. He was the U.S. captain that year, and he had to pull a lot of strings to get the PGA of America to host a tournament at Laurel Valley. That was also back in the days when the U.S. used to dominate the event. Do you mind sharing what you wrote and what you learned about the 75 Ryder Cup?
Yeah, so the 75 Ryder Cup is really one of the more pivotal ones in history, and it's not because of the outcome necessarily of, you know, it's not because of the golf that was played. So at that point, coming into the 75th or the 1975 Ryder Cup, I think the Americans had lost three matches overall and tied one or two others. And, you know, I think they had a record of 15 or 18, 3-2 or something like that. It was just an absurd record of dominance. And, you know, by that point, there was a lot of conversations of like, should we even keep this going? You know, at that point, it was still Great Britain and so England and Scottish players. And then officially, I think in 1973, Ireland was part of that, even though Irish players had been playing for about 15 or 20 years at that point. But, you know, the Ryder Cup was kind of, you know, it's hard to fathom that it was, you know, it ever struggled. And it really was in 1975. So the PGA of America decided to name Arnold Palmer captain with the hope of kind of, you know, improving their standing at that point on Arnie's shoulders. And Arnie convinced them to bring the Ryder Cup to Laurel Valley, where the PGA Championship had been held a decade earlier, to much success. And, you know, Laurel just is, it's such a wonderful place. I've been out there a couple times working on projects of late, and it's just such a cool place, and has this, you know, it has that Palmer aura to it, but it also just has this great feel, like, you know, you're at one of these iconic venues. And, you know, so Mr. Palmer was named captain, and you look at his team and, you know, you kind of think about the 27 Yankees, like, it was truly a murderer's row. I mean, the rookies on that team were Johnny Miller, Hale Irwin, and I want to say maybe, I think, I don't know if Tom Weisskopf was a rookie that year or not, but I mean, it was, you know, and then you had Lee Trevino, Billy Casper, Jack Nicklaus. I mean, just, you look at it on paper and you would think, why are we even going to bother teeing it up? And, you know, they did anyway. And, you know, it was a traditional American dominant performance. They ended up winning. I forget what the score was off the top of my head, but it was a dominant victory. And really the one, you know, downside to it was, you know, Jack actually lost both of his single matches on Sunday. He lost to Brian Barnes in the morning, I think 3-2. And, you know, they had a press conference afterwards. And as soon as he was done talking to the press, he found Mr. Palmer and was like, I want him again. I am not going to let him beat me again. And it was the first time in Ryder Cup history that they actually changed the Sunday pairings. Back then it was two Sunday singles matches. You had a match in the morning and then a match in the afternoon. And it had been the first time in history that they had actually changed the submitted matches, so Jack could play Brian Barnes again. And lo and behold, Brian Barnes beat him again that afternoon. And it's, you know, truly one of those great stories of that. And One of the other great stories, which I would point to a couple of podcasts that Lee Trevino has done in recent years, and he talks about how, you know, he was, you know, the matches were clinched in the morning singles, and he was tired. He was one of the older guys on the team, and, you know, he basically kind of told Arnie, you know, send the kids out. Like, it's over. Let them play it. Like, I'm done. And, you know, Lee Trevino, and then Mr. Palmer told Lee, goes, oh, no, the governor's waiting on the first tee for you. So, you know, Lee said, well, I'll go back out, but I need a six pack of Rolling Rock. And, you know, the bar room attendant or the locker room attendant brought him the six pack. And, you know, he spent 20 minutes drinking a couple of the beers. And he ended up on the first tee and went to go shake the governor's hand and missed and played it off as a joke. And I forget which podcast I heard him say it. I think it was either No Laying Up or Golf Subpar. You know, he said, he goes, yeah, I played it off real good, but I missed it. I didn't do it on purpose. Kind of thing. And you know, he went on to, I think he went on to lose the match 3-2, but, you know, it was just, you know, the true character that Lee Trevino was at that point in his life, it still is for that matter. But I make the argument in that chapter when I talk about the 75 Ryder Cup of how it really is the first catalyst in changing it into the modern Ryder Cup we know. Because, you know, in 1977, they go across the pond. I forget the site of it, Royal Birkdale or Lytham and St. Anne's. I forget exactly where. You know, Tom Weisskopf decides not to play. He'd rather go bighorn hunting up in Canada. And, you know, the American players, you know, dominate again. And, you know, Jack actually pulls the head of the British PGA aside and it's like, look, you guys need to do something to make this more competitive. Like, you know, it's not fair to us. It's not fair to you guys that we come out and, you know, we're beating you guys so bad. It's not fun. You know, it's not good for the game. Like, we need to do something. And, you know, to the credit of the British PGA at the time, they took Jack's words to heart and they changed. And, you know, 1979, Europe is, you know, it is no longer just Great Britain and Ireland. It is now the entirety of continental Europe. And, you know, even though they don't win in 1979 or 1981, it's the start of something great. And I think Shane Ryan, the writer for Golf Digest, you know, he had a great podcast series on, you know, what saved the Ryder Cup back in the 80s. And he devotes a good part of his book, The Cup They Couldn't Lose, to this as well. You know, essentially, Tony Jacklin and Seve Ballesteros make the Ryder Cup what it is now today, starting in the 80s. You know, Tony Jacklin changed the way that the Europeans were going to prepare and dress and things like that. And, you know, and Seve changed the way that the players were going to think and the players were going to perform. And, you know, they lose narrowly in 1983. And, you know, Seve said, this is a great victory. This is the beginning. We can beat these guys. And then in 85, they win. And then in 87, they beat the Americans here in the United States, and then they tie again in 1989. And, you know, I think without the 75 Ryder Cup being a blowout and then the subsequent blowout in 77 and Jack speaking up, like, is the Ryder Cup what it is today without that Ryder Cup here in 1975? And I don't know that it is, but it definitely was a catalyst in changing it. And, you know, I don't know how most people feel. I'm sure the Europeans are very happy, but I kind of hope that there is a bit of a shift in the way things are going for the American team. And, you know, they kind of start to look at changing things the way that Tony Jacklin and Seve Ballesteros did back in the late 70s and early 80s.
David, one more before I let you go.
Sure.
Hawks Chapel is another highly regarded course in the area that played the U.S. Women's Senior Open there last year.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that course, and in particular, when the U.S. Blind Golfers Association National Championship was played there back in 1984.
Fox Chapel is awesome. I think it's, you know, Oakmont obviously gets most of the accolades around here, but I think Fox Chapel is probably the second best course, you know, in this area. It's a Seth Rayner. It's been masterfully restored in recent years to really feel like a Rayner course again. It's hosted various national championships with U.S. Women's Amateur, U.S. Senior Amateur. But yeah, 1983, 1984, somewhere right in there is the National Blind Golfers Amateur Championship. And We don't dedicate a full chapter to it. It probably could have been a full chapter, but you know, that organization dates back to the 1920s, and then I believe the championship dates back to the 30s or 40s, somewhere in there. And the gentleman that won at Fox Chapel won, I believe, 20 of 20 National Blind Golfers Championships in total. He didn't win them in a row, but it was very, very close. I think he won like 8 in a row, lost one, won 6 more, lost one, then won 4 or 5 more. So the win at Fox Chapel was somewhere in that streak. I should say in one of those streaks. But yeah, Fox Chapel is just such a brilliant golf course. It's brilliantly designed. It's wonderfully manicured. It has a ton of history behind it. You know, if you ever get the invite to go to Fox Chapel, never turn it down, because it truly is one of those special golf courses here in Western Pennsylvania.
David, before I let you go, remind our listeners again, how can they get a copy of Volume 1 or now Volume 2 of the book, plus stay up to date with all the great things that you're out there doing?
So you can pick up a second edition copy of Battling the Church Views on Amazon. I believe the paperbacks are $25 a piece. The hardcovers are $35 a piece. It's over 500 pages of golf history. You know, a lot of blood, sweat, and tears went into it. Really proud of what this book has become. So please, you know, please support the book and grab it on Amazon. As far as what I'm up to, you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram. My handle is the PA Golf Historian. You know, I post stuff, you know, the different articles I'm writing and working on, different projects I'm working on with various clubs. Very excited for some things that are coming down the chute here with some more writing. And, you know, I'm very fortunate that the phone is ringing as far as the clubs are concerned. So we're uncovering more and more golf history every day with some of the best clubs, not only here in the Pittsburgh area, but across the country. And I'm really excited for some of the projects that I'm starting to really dig into here now in the next couple of weeks. So, but yeah, follow me on Twitter and Instagram at PA Golf Historian, and support the book. Really appreciate it.
David, you're fantastic, my friend. I hope you'll come back very soon and update us on some of the great projects that you're out there working on. Take us on the ride with you. But you're just one of the gems that I've had an opportunity to get to know. And then, like I say, got to spend a little time with you at Oakmont at the U.S. Open. And then, obviously, the third time having you here on the show. I hope we get this privilege with you again before too long.
Anytime, Chris. You know me. I love to talk golf history. So anytime you need somebody, give me a call.
I'll do it. Take care, David. All the best to you and your family. We'll catch up soon.
You too, buddy. Thank you so much.
See you, David.
Bye-bye.
That is David Moore, folks. Again, Battling the Church Views, Volume 2, now out at PA Golf Historian is where you can follow him on social media. Just a gem of a human being. I got to, like I say, I got to spend a little bit of time at Oakmont with him and talking about what was happening, going on out there. And it was a wonderful few minutes of his time. I was so thankful that I could get a few of them. Very busy week for him, obviously. But, now, when you talk about one of the great golf historians, he's probably the best of our time, not just in Western Pennsylvania, but like he talked about there at the end, he's doing stuff all over the country now with different clubs, bringing back the historical relics that they have and the stories that are there that, you know, we all just love to hear all those old stories. How about those great stories about Ben Hogan and what it was like in 1953 and then going back in time at Oakmont and some of these other great courses in and around Western Pennsylvania, Mr. Palmer and the great things there, the 75 Ryder Cup. He's just fantastic. Again, follow him on social media at PA Golf Historian and go pick up Volume 2 of the book, Battling the Church Views. We'll get David back on the show again here and update us on the projects he's working on before too long. All right, my friends, it is time for me to put a bow on this episode of Next on the Tee. My sincere thanks go out again to Kenny Knox, Darren Davis, and David Moore for being a part of this week's show. Scheduled to join me next week are the great Ron Cyrak will be back. It's always special getting to spend some time with Ron. Really looking forward to that. We'll get a regular monthly visit from the confidence doctor, Dr. Bob Winters. PGA professional David Eby will make his next On the Tee debut. And then we'll round things out with a return visit from top 50 instructor Jeff Smith. So it's going to be a really good time, folks. All four of those guys are fantastic. Jeff Smith, one of my all-time favorites. Obviously, Dr. Bob Winters, who's on the show frequently. Ron Cyrak, How great is that guy? Each and every time he's a part of anything, he makes it so much better by the fact that he was a part of it. And then getting to get introduced to David Eby, I can't wait for that as well. So I hope you'll come back and be a part of the show with us. I want to thank our friends again over at the Pittsburgh Tribune Review for hosting this show on their site. For coverage of everything going on out there in Western Pennsylvania, including your favorite sports, go to triblive.com. And you can find this show by then clicking on the sports section tab. And you're going to see the most recent episode of the show front and center on the homepage of the sports section. Or you can click on sports and then podcast network. Then you're going to see the Next on the Tee logo. If you click on that, many of the most recent episodes from this season are right there for you as well. You can also find the show out on Good Pods, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, GolfNewsNet.com. Pretty much anywhere you get your podcast content, Next on the Tee is there for you as well. And a big thank you again to God, the folks over at the W3 Awards, the Academy of Interactive and Visual Arts, my wonderful guests, and all of you for the show being awarded gold for individual episodes and specials in the podcast category. I am so stoked, and it's such a tremendous honor. I couldn't be more grateful to everybody involved with making this show what it is. But as always, as I say each and every episode, my biggest thanks continue to go out to all of you for being the greatest supporters in the history of podcasts. You guys made that happen. I appreciate it so very much. Until next time, hit 'em straight, my friends.
Thanks for joining Chris again this week on Next on the Tee. We hope you enjoyed the conversations as much as we did. Please share the show with your golf buddies and be sure to follow it on TribLive or your favorite podcast app so you never miss an episode. Thanks for pressing play and being part of the journey. We'll see you next week, right here, where the best minds in golf share their stories.